So today I'm going to finish this 12-part series on the 12 steps of the transcendental dependent origination. And talking about it since the beginning of the year. How many of you have come to most of those, would you say? So the majority of people have only been to maybe a few of them, maybe none of them. So you have no clue what I'm talking about. Today being the last, the pinnacle, culmination of it, the punchline. It's one of the very interesting aspects of Buddhism historically. In almost all schools of Buddhism, not universal, but it's pretty common. It was pretty common in the teachings of the Buddha, was that he presented the path of spiritual practice as a path. The Sanskrit word is marga. In Pali, it's magga. And as a path, as a gradual development, gradual cultivation, a step-by-step path that leads to full awakening, and for some people to Buddhahood, if they so choose to take that path. And he called it a path. It's called a path. And one of the interesting aspects of a path, as Stephen Batchelor pointed out last week when I heard him speak, a path is a clearing in the woods or in the field or something. A path is an absence of something. It's an absence of obstacles. So you can make your way through the woods or through wherever you're going without being obstructed by anything. You can follow this absence of obstacles through an area where there's lots of obstacles, maybe, and find your way. Some paths are quite direct, and that's the virtue, is they show you the direct way. And in terrain where there are lots of obstacles, the path maybe is winding. But still, it provides a clearing for which we freeze our life of obstacles. We can go ahead. Now, for some people, it's a path, not because the path is free of obstacles. Maybe the path is there for us to follow. But since the last time someone walked on it, it's gotten overgrown. So that in our particular negotiation of the path, we have to clear the path. We have to kind of find out what the obstacles are and address them and somehow clear them out of the way so that our path becomes obstacle-free. And some Buddhists will focus simply on what it's like to take each step on the path. And some Buddhists will focus more on the long-term possibilities of that path and lay out the whole realm of it. I like it that the Buddha talked about the path as being good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And this means that it's a good thing all along. It's not like it's your second best to be at the beginning and you're hoping to get to the middle, or you get to the end, that's really the best deal of all. But rather, the famous saying that is kind of cliche now is, wherever you go, there you are. That wherever you are, that's where we negotiate our life. That's where we discover our life. That's where we work with the obstacles of our life. And to be engaged with our life as it's lived right now is the only thing we can do. You can't be engaged with your life as for the wishful thinking that, I hope that in the future, if I dream enough, if I fantasize enough of what I could be, then maybe I'll somehow miraculously be that. It'd be kind of like reading a menu and never ordering a food. So the path is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. Some people will focus mostly on what it's like to take each step on the path and find some great value in just waking up here right now in this moment. And waking up in this moment to your life as it is to some degree relatively easy if you just remember to do it. I was coming down here today and at some point driving down the hill, I noticed that I had been involved in composing a story. or rewriting an ancient Buddhist story in my head. And it was a pleasant thing to do, but someone I noticed I was doing it, and I kind of woke up from that storytelling, and the road and the trees and the traffic and the street sign that I kind of was driving by was suddenly very vivid and very present for me in a very wonderful way. And then I noticed, you know, I wondered, here I'm driving my car, and I don't remember any memory of seeing anything on the road before that. I'm sure I was conscious and a good driver. I don't think I was, you know, completely out of it. But I wasn't so present that it was vividly alive for me that it registered in some strong way. This is what's happening in the present moment. I was living in story making, as many people, we live sometimes in memories or in planning or whatever. And it is a kind of sleeping state, or kind of dull state or unattentive state. So then I was present for this very simple, you know, woodside road and the rain and the trees and whatever's going on there. And I could easily imagine someone feel that this is not very special. Just a road, and we see roads all the time. Just trees, we see trees all the time. It's just a person driving. It's, you know, big deal. It's actually kind of boring. It's, you know, it's kind of like very mundane. And it's, you know, human beings can aspire to much loftier things than just simply being present for a road. And in the present moment, sometimes for some people can have the appearance of it's not good for anything. You know, this particular moment that I find myself in, you know, I'll just hurry and get through this moment so that I could get to work where the really important work of my life is, or hurry and get home so I can do the really important work of watching television, or whatever we think is really important. There's all these lofty things we can do in our life, some of them which are very worthwhile doing. And we can sacrifice the present moment because the present moment seems rather uninteresting, maybe, compared to these lofty things we can do, exciting things we might be able to do. But what happens is that as we begin finding ourselves more in the present moment, willing to take a chance to just kind of explore and be in the present moment, it allows, I found, that it allows a state of simplicity, a state of ease, a state of calm or peacefulness to kind of bubble up and surface. And that state of simplicity then becomes phenomenally rich. And that if I'm always involved in doing something and engaged in projects and things that are really important and exciting, there is a certain kind of satisfaction that comes from that. But the deep inner satisfaction and joy and delight of simplicity, of just being fully alive with no need to do anything, to be present without the mind always needing to grasp onto some activity or some desire, but rather the mind is resting and just present for things as they are. That is not available to us if we're always engaged in these wonderful things. So beginning to kind of settle back and just be very simply with the simple things of life, the roads, the steering wheel as you're driving, the sound of the rain, whatever it is, just find ourselves with the present moment as it is, allows for the growth of some real deep sense of intimacy and presence that I think is ultimately the most satisfying. It's much more satisfying than some of the exciting things we can do. That's my experience or my feeling about it. But this willing to kind of be present and awake for the moment, as it actually is, then some people see that as ultimate in itself. Some people find it's very satisfying. Some people have found the great satisfaction of just being awake in this moment. Nothing else is needed. To be really awake is to have a mindfulness which can see clearly or be present fully for what's here and is not trying or needing it to be any different, which means it does not pushing anything away or is not holding on to anything in the mind. The mind doesn't have the contractions of pushing away or holding on to anything. Your body might decide, you might decide through your wisdom to make changes in the world, but the mind doesn't have to contract for or against anything. It can stay open towards everything. Some people find that phenomenally powerful and freeing and liberating. They don't feel there's any need to talk about any other developmental model of a path. There's no need to get anything or attain anything. It just seems so full to be present without wanting or rejecting, just there and open. Um, However, if we do that, if we sit completely open and present and aware without wanting anything or pushing anything away, you involve yourself in a process of change. You might not be wanting to cause change. You might not be interested in change. You might be satisfied with life as it is. But life continues anyway. And so you involve yourself in a process of change, inner change, that I think is actually quite phenomenal. I think there's a phenomenal movement, momentum within us, if we get the obstacles out of the way, towards freedom, towards release. And so whatever way we can, kind of lower or drop the obstacles, we let this momentum, this process happen on its own. We don't have to attribute the process of liberation, the path, the developmental model of that, is always something that we will and want to happen or making happen, but rather it's something that happens to us if we get out of the obstacles out of the way. Maybe the path is downhill. You know, once we get on the path and don't have any obstacles, we'll just slide down the hill. On a rainy day, you know, the mud's wet, right? And we just, down we go. I've told this story many times, but it's kind of an example of this way in which if you don't want change, that itself is the great change maker. I think there's so much non-acceptance of our life for many of us that it's actually a very radical thing to practice mindfulness as an accepting of life as it is right now. That movement of going from not different states and reactive states of non-acceptance to acceptance of things as they are pulls the rug from underneath much of the structure of our life, much of the way in which our life is held up and is going along. So you pull the rug from under the whole cathedral of ways in which we're defending ourselves and building ourselves up as in our self-image kind of falls away, and we're involved in change and that falling away. So the story is the one of this man is writing a letter, I guess, he says, I was miserable, I was depressed, I felt awful, and my friends all told me that I had to change. And I knew that I had to change. And the more I tried to change, the less successful I was at changing. I became more miserable. Then one day I came across a friend who told me, don't change. I love you just the way you are. I love you just the way you are. What a relief to hear those words. I relaxed, and then I changed. And what I didn't know was I couldn't change. I think I don't know how it continues, but I couldn't change unless somehow there was someone loved me for who I was without needing to change. And that someone in Buddhist practice is ourselves. Can we love ourselves, that, you know, as we are, without the need for change, in a sense? And that's actually a very powerful way of causing change, causing kind of the cathedral of structures of defense or timidity or whatever it is to fall away. So Buddhism offers a path, and these weeks I'm going over the 12 steps of this path. Actually, the Buddha offered many models of the path. Eightfold Path that you know, this most famous path. There's many developmental models the Buddha offered. Since he offered many of them, I think we take all each of them lightly. We don't consider any one path as being the ultimate path, but kind of just see them as being useful way of looking at our life, our practice, rather than our life has to fit in any particular one of them. So it began with suffering. The path begins with suffering. And some acknowledgement there's suffering in ourselves or in the world out there. There's some problem that needs to be addressed, some issue that needs to be addressed. And without some full acknowledgement and recognition of the problems of our life, the difficulty of our life, some kind of particular kind of acceptance of it, it's very hard to want to be engaged in a spiritual practice or know where the spiritual practice is supposed to go. It's very easy to be idealistic in any kind of spiritual practice. Some people get turned off by the world of spirituality in California because a tremendous amount of idealism that's presented. And it's very confusing and very hard to find our way in a very idealistic world that seems to offer a lot of hope, but doesn't really help us really understand where the beginning should be, where the problem is. So the path begins in recognizing and seeing suffering, to see what our actual situation is and be very honest about it. And some people find that Buddhist spirituality offers a tremendous amount of relief to them, because it says, it begins where we're actually at. Oh, it's speaking to me, my condition, how I actually am. And then it follows, next step is some faith. That out of suffering comes faith. And I think that's very profound. Many people want to have more faith, or more trust, or more confidence. And that somehow it follows the recognition of suffering. The faith is many things. One of them is a faith that there's a path to follow. There's something you can do about your problems in your life, something you can do about your suffering. You don't have to just accept it complacently, or accept it kind of dejected, depressed way, or just kind of give up. Acceptance is not giving up to something. It's in the deep way of practice. Practice acceptance is not the same thing as, you know, as complacent, despairing acceptance, which sometimes we have. So faith that there's something possible to do something, faith that there's a path, faith that there's a practice, faith that there are other people who've been engaged in the path, have done it ahead of us, and can offer us inspiration, advice, can point out the obstacles in the path that we'll encounter. Maybe they've cleared the path for us at some point, so at least we can find, maybe there's still obstacles in our path, but you can kind of, you know, traces of the path are still there, and so we can find our way. We don't have to kind of invent it all anew. And then after some development of faith, or the arising of faith, there's the next two stages, which is delight and joy. And for me, this is has very much to do with working on our interpersonal relationships. I like to think of the Buddhist path as putting early in the path, focusing on developing healthy interpersonal relationships. Many people who look at Buddhist practice think that it's primarily an individual practice, you know, meditation practice, you close your eyes, you're all by yourself, and it's about negotiating your life just on your own, kind of solving and fixing it, as if you can just kind of take care of everything just by yourself. And in several of the models of the path in Buddhism, the early stages involve interrelational activity, working out those relationships, clearing them up to some degree, making sure they're somehow healthy. And this is done in two primary ways. One is through ethics, virtue, which simply means developing healthy, harmonious relationships with people around us. There's nothing more moralistic about it. And then the second one is through a practice of generosity. We look for opportunities to be generous, and you don't do generosity in the abstract. It usually has to do with others. It's a relational thing that we tend to do. So we start looking at our relationships, and our practice occurs in the field of relationships. It's not, again, not a solitary activity. But we begin feeling how our practice is connected to others and how our life is connected to others. And that creates a very important, I think, foundation for the inner life, the inner spiritual life that follows that. Many Westerners start with themselves. We have such a painful individualistic society here in America. And we don't even see it. It's built in, you know, from the time we're young. You know, we don't see how strong and powerful the conditioning we have to be autonomous, individual, self-reliant, self-sufficient beings. I heard a story last week of a Japanese woman, a Japanese family that came to America. And they sent their 5-year-old daughter to kindergarten, I suppose. And at some point, the kindergarten teacher asked all the kids what their favorite color was. And everyone said their favorite color, and they came to a Japanese girl, and she looked kind of stunned and didn't know what to say, and she said, "I don't know what our favorite color is." And then she went back to her parents and said, "What's our favorite color?" And the mother called up the school and said, "What's going on here? What are you guys doing to my daughter?" The idea so the daughter's assumption was she didn't have her favorite color as an individual. She had a favorite color that came, you know, was part of her community, part of her family. I'm not saying it's a better way of raising children or having families, but it's a very different one. And it highlights the fact that here in America, something so innocent and simple, we think it's just like, you know, we do it as we breathe. What's your favorite color? As if you should have a favorite color. That's, you know, that's actually a very powerful form of cultural conditionings, and it expresses a certain understanding of what the individual is. And it feeds into this phenomenon, I think it feeds into, that might be healthy in itself in our culture, but it feeds into this phenomenally unhealthy tendency of being individuals. Let me do it on my own. My life. So the Buddhist path begins with some sense of interrelationship, some sense of connectedness. And as you practice more harmonious relationships, practice joy, practice generosity, practice ethics, traditionally that's understood that it brings joy and delight and joy to our life. Not a moralistic and heavy thing to do, but it brings some kind of lightness. We can walk through life in a blameless way, is the words of the expression of the Buddha, to live a blameless life. And that brings joy and delight. And it doesn't mean you have to be good at it or pure at it. It means, like, I find there's a lot of delight and joy in knowing that I'm interested in harmonious relationships, interested in ethics and developing a pure heart. To be engaged in that attempt, I think, is really beautiful. I don't measure myself against some model of perfection doing it. I measure myself in against my interest in wanting to do that and my engagement in that process. With the recognition that many different people are many different stages and levels of ethics and relationships. And what's important is their intention, not where they're at. So then that joy, delight and joy is followed by tranquility. Because once you're blameless, and once you begin having harmonious relationships and have some sense of how to live your life in a simple way, a basic, decent way, it tends to bring some level of tranquility to our life. Many people in the West are not tranquil. Anxiety is epidemic. Maybe it's contagious. The degree to which the various forms of anxiety, including depression, is so prevalent in our culture, I think means that we shouldn't just take it, again, as a personal occurrence. That I think there's an element in which depression and anxiety in our culture is a cultural phenomenon that we've somehow, we're participating in. It's cultural conditioning and cultural circumstances. I think many of the people who feel anxious and depressed in our culture, I don't know what the immediate causes and conditions for it, but the wider conditions of it, I think, are the alienated, work-driven society we have. And that if we had lived in a small village where you knew what your job was, because that's what your generations before you had always done the same kind of work, and you knew that's what your place in the world was, and it's the community of people you've known you all your life, I suspect that a lot fewer people would be depressed. People historically have never had to make as many decisions for themselves as people in the modern world have to make. And so, I think it's helpful to realize that it's not just always so personal, even our psychological difficulties. But anyway, we work on these things, and it comes some modicum or some development of tranquility, a little bit of peace or settledness in ourselves, willing to settle back on ourselves and be ourselves, not run away from ourselves or avoid ourselves. And then that brings happiness. The ability to have some tranquility, some settledness in ourselves, is a condition that brings happiness. And happiness is a little more profound or sublime than joy or delight. Happiness is also very helpful for the development of concentration, which is an important element of meditation practice. Actually, the deeper stages of concentration arise with happiness, as happiness is a foundation. And so, you know, if your meditation doesn't have I want to say maybe happiness is too strong of a word, but if happiness or joy is not an element of your meditation, so it doesn't happen right away, but eventually at some point, if you're doing for a number of years and you're not feeling some delight or joy or happiness or ease in your meditation, you should probably talk to a teacher and explore maybe what's happening there. And happiness is then a precursor for the possibility of concentration. To have a mind which is very stable and very still and quiet, very focused in the present moment, so that we can not just simply kind of see something in the passing, but we actually can look very deeply, very profoundly, look into something and really see deeply what the nature is, what the characteristics of our experience are, in a way that goes deeper than our conceptual level. It's deeper than how we think about things or interpret things or judge things. But we see very deeply how things actually are. Concentration then is a precursor for seeing things as they are, which is the essential element of Vipassana practice, and being able to see clearly what things are in contrast to what we think they are. To seeing things as they are is the precursor for beginning to become disenchanted with the things that we're enchanted with, disillusioned with the things we have illusions about, beginning to slowly let go of the grasping and holding which of objects which we think are going to give us lasting security and happiness, to stop looking outside of ourselves for our ultimate well-being, but to begin actually looking, finding it inside of us, in a sense. In the Buddhist mythology, there's Brahma, the great god. He's kind of like the greatest god of the Indian pantheon. He mistook himself to be the creator god for a while, but the Buddhists straightened him out and showed him how it was a misunderstanding. One of the wonderful things about these great gods like Brahma is they have everything. You know, they're like a CEO of heaven. In one of the heavens, there's many heavens in Buddhism. The CEO of heaven, they have this phenomenal, you know, big home in Los Altos Hills. They have somewhere like that. They have, you know, the greatest cars, and they have all the money they want, and the best vacations, and the greatest, you know, everything. You know, everything in the world, all the best that the world can provide for joy and have, you know, delight or sensual pleasure. These Brahmas have it, you know. Does Larry Ellison too, you know. He looks pretty poor and snotty in comparison. And the Brahma realizes that that's not good enough, that's not enough. And the Brahma actually is very interested in the Buddha and goes, listens to the Buddha and talks to the Buddha and somehow offers support and protection for the Buddha, because the Brahma sees that the Buddha has something which he doesn't have, and that is this phenomenal inner sense of well-being and peace and happiness, which doesn't come from the world and conditions around us. So kind of a disenchantment with that the world out there is going to do it for us, and we learn to begin to relax our grip on the world, because we start getting disenchanted with whatever it is we're enchanted with, day trading or whatever. It might be the current enchantment. And then with this enchantment, there's a beginning of a turning away, or turning away is maybe a good word, a fading away of, we don't simply get this enchanted with this. So like, if you're really enchanted with a bowl, you can realize that you can holding on to this bowl is really going to do it for you. You're sure of it. You're not going to let anybody take this bowl away. You're going to hold on to it. And you're really happy to have a bowl. Now, the function of a bowl, of course, is to make a beautiful sound as you ring it. Now, if you're really attached to the bowl, it's really going to do it for you, and you're not going to let go of your grip at all. So at some point, you might realize, oh, wait a minute, this bowl is not going to do it for me. And so the disenchantment is realizing the bowl is not going to do it for me. The turning away or the fading is a fading of our grip, which follows the disenchantment. We let go of the grip. And then as we let go of the grip, the bowl has a wonderful function. And we hear the beautiful sound. So as we start getting disenchanted, the grip begins to loosen on what we're enchanted with. And really what's important is not so much the object that we're attached to, but we begin loosening that grip of our attachment. Attachment has all kinds of shapes, right? Aversion, hate, hostility, desire, greed, fear, confusion, stress. Virtually all stress arises out of a kind of some gripping onto something. And then once the fading away of our gripping becomes thorough enough, then there is a release. The ball is set free, in a sense, floats away, or whatever. Once the fading away, once the holding has released itself, and the last remnants of attachment or holding or gripping, the last fetters that bind our heart, the last constrictions of our heart and our mind have released themselves, then we have the experience of freedom, of release. And in the teachings of Buddhism, freedom is very important. It's like the ultimate goal. However, in American society, it's important to distinguish two different ideas of freedom. One is, in America, I think many people want to have freedom to do, freedom of ability to do whatever they want, freedom of speech, freedom to vote, freedom to purchase, freedom to, you know, have vacations, freedom to do whatever we want to do. Which is, I mean, I'm not critical of that, but that kind of freedom also lends itself to this individualistic notion: what's in it for me? I don't want to have any obstacles to my desires and my wishes. The freedom that the Buddha talked about is the freedom from. And what you have freedom to do, that's up to you. You have to figure that out depending on the circumstances. But freedom from means freedom from that which constrains or constricts our heart or our mind. The contractions of clinging, of hate, of aversion, greed, hate, and delusion are released. And what that life is like, of freedom, what the mind or the heart or our life is like when we're released from that which binds the heart, the Buddha didn't talk about very much. And it may be somewhat unusual in the world of spiritual traditions by not having very many positive descriptions of what freedom feels like or looks like or how it's experienced. He didn't say, great, boundless white light's going to fill you, or you're going to boundless joy, or great visions, or experiences of infinite consciousness, or he didn't describe it, except to describe primarily by describing what was lacking, what was absent, what you'd been released from. And I think there's great beauty and wisdom in not describing the ultimate goal in a positive terms, but rather describing it as what you've been released from. One of them is, it's very respectful, very respectful of how different people's experiences are. And maybe there are different ways in which people experience the ultimate experience of release and freedom. And in fact, when Vipassana teachers, when they get together to talk, the teachers who've had a lot of experience and practice, very deep practice in it, will sometimes share amongst themselves what their deepest practice or the deepest experiences are in practice. And they all kind of fit a certain model that, kind of fits the kind of, somehow in the traditional Buddhist model in a very general way. But there's a phenomenal amount of variety of how they had their ultimate experiences of practice. And it's a little bit awing, I think, for some of the teachers to hear how different the different teachers had followed the path and had very different ultimate experiences of sorts, or experienced in somewhat different ways. And so I think that what's developed here, because we talk with each other, is that a kind of great respect. Who knows what the ultimate experience is supposed to be like? Is it one unitary experience? It's supposed to be it, and that's it. The Buddha focused on, you understand it by understanding what you released, what's been released from you. You no longer have greed, you no longer have hate, you no longer have attachment to a sense of self, you no longer have conceit, you no longer have attachment to very subtle states of bliss, of joy, of consciousness. You no longer are driven by compulsions of sensual or sexual desires. You're no longer driven by compulsions for aversion or hate. There's no longer this absence of restlessness, and there's the absence of ignorance. So those things, you know, those things I think the Vipassana teacher all understand, the importance of and the cultivation of that and moving in that direction. But what happens when all this, kind of like once the curtains are pulled, you know, everybody lives in their own home by themselves, and everybody has their curtains pulled. It's always very dark, and they're kind of moldy, and you know, and their skin's turning dark or whatever, green or white or whatever happens. And then somehow you read this wonderful book. Everybody reads this wonderful book about practice, and it says, you know, sooner or later you better open your curtains and open the windows. So everybody in their own little homes actually opens their curtains and looks out the window, and everybody sees something different. But the experience of opening the curtains is the same. And that's enough. Everybody's happy. Wow, I didn't know there was so much more to life. So the 11th stage is the experience of release. The 12th stage, the final part of this transcendental dependent origination, is the knowledge. These are called, all these stages are called knowledges, but it is called a knowledge of what has been eliminated. So that the experience of enlightenment or freedom, in the Buddhist terms, comes also, is followed also with some reflection, some awareness of what the consequences of that experience has been, what has been released, what's been removed from what person. And there's many lists of things that are removed, and depending on how your mood that day, you can look at the different lists and evaluate that way. The most important list here, in this 12th stage, is the list of the asavas, the removal of the asavas. And asavas is a great word. It has many, etymologically, has a number of different meanings. One meaning is it's the sap of a certain plant in India that's intoxicating. Another meaning, it's the discharge of pus from a sore. Psychologically, in Buddhism, it's kind of like both. It's some people call it the drains, that which, you know, drains your energy. You no longer have any drains in your system. But some people translate it as the outflows. But probably the best translation is the intoxicants. We tend to be intoxicated by our infatuations, by what enchants us. And so someone who's totally liberated no longer has any intoxication of the mind, which bewilders them, befuddles them, confuses them, leads them to live a compulsive life, a driven life, but rather this freedom to live the life as appropriate. So there's a list of three, a list of four asavas, intoxicants, and one of them is this drive for sensual pleasure. That it's not so difficult for some people to realize how foundational it is in many people's lives, the drive for pleasure. The second is the drive, the intoxication of what's called bhava, becoming, or identity. Maybe the best way of saying it in the Western terminology is the drive to be someone, becoming, to have it, to create an identity for ourselves. We all are something, but we don't have to create something in addition to that in terms of a self-image, a way in which we want to present ourselves to the world, or present ourselves to ourselves, defend ourselves in a certain way. We have tremendous attachment to identity. And there's a difference between having an identity and identifying. Identifying being the attachment. And one of the fundamental spiritual needs in Buddhist practice is to address the issue of identification and find the possibility of releasing ourselves from the grip of identification. So one of the very profound intoxications is the intoxication of identity, needing to be someone or not be someone, which is the way some people want to be, at least trying to avoid at all costs to be anybody. They're afraid to be anybody. They want to be nobody. The fourth, and the list, third, when there's a list of four, is opinions. We get intoxicated by our opinions, and they befuddle us and confuse us and cause a lot of suffering. and someone who's fully awakened has removed any kind of attachment or association with opinions. Even if they're right, they don't have to defend it or whatever. And then the last one, the list of four, is ignorance. Ignorance is a form of intoxication. Because in Buddhist terminology, ignorance is not the absence of knowing something, but rather it's the act of ignoring. And the act of ignoring, maybe in Freudian terms, is called denial. But the act of ignoring is a tremendous cause of suffering in the world, both in ourselves and the world around us. And one of the most profound aspects of liberation is the liberation of our ignorance, of our act of ignoring, of turning away, not paying attention. So that's the developmental model. In years that I've taught and in the years that I have been talking to other teachers, it's the experience that very few people follow a linear model of development. And linear models are useful as kind of abstract kind of pictures or something, or for discussion, exploration, but that people kind of jump around all over the place. Also, my impression is that human beings are multidimensional. And this is something that as Buddhism and practices has developed in the West, the number of different teachers have also pointed out that they're multidimensional, multi-level to human being. So it's possible for someone to have very deep practice, very deep, even realization experiences in Buddhism, experiences of liberation, of awakening, experiences of the unconditioned, the experience of non-duality. And then to come back from that experience and continue to be a psychological mess. And it can even worse. Some people can have very dramatic enlightenment experiences and get arrogant because of it, become kind of jerks because of it, which we've known to happen. So there's sometimes like a psychological level that sometimes is not addressed by even very deep practice. And so some teachers, Jack Kornfield was one of the first, and he got a lot of criticism for doing that because he was being too psychological. But he insisted that some people really need to look at other aspects of their life than just the spiritual aspect of their life. They really wanted to be free. And he got a lot of flack for that. And then I was fascinated when I went to England last July at the Vipassana teachers meeting. There were 60 different Vipassana teachers there. For the first time, the monks from Amaravati and Chithurst were there, monks and nuns. So far, in the years past, these meetings have always been just lay Vipassana teachers. And the monastic community in England, where Ajahn Amaro comes from, is kind of a bastion of conservative Theravada teachings, and they kind of looked at California as like, California Buddhism is, boy, these people there, all the psychology, what's going on there? And in the last few years, they've realized the need to invite in psychologists to help them. That they had enough difficulties in their community, both in group process and individual process, that they realized that they couldn't do it on their own anymore. And there were aspects that they, and some of the tremendous fascination then with psychology and different forms of therapy, because they felt it wasn't enough just to do the practice itself. And maybe practice itself is enough if you understand the whole path. Some people, we focus so narrowly on what Buddhist practice is, and we don't understand that it's maybe that the developmental model being one that is meant to take in the full scope of who we are. And if we don't take in the whole model, then we have to fill in that from other areas of life or from other traditions, from psychology or whatever. This idea that liberation is a process or a path, that if we know how to practice well, moves through us, that it kind of occurs to us, and not something necessarily we do or make happen. I think it's very profound. It means a kind of trust in our life, in our full life, our embodied life, our mental life, our emotional life. And I see plenty of people who can have some real experience or some intuitive experience of the unconditioned, of a non-dual experience, of freedom, but from whom that itself becomes a kind of, maybe not an attachment perhaps, but a kind of narrowing of their life rather than an opening into the full meaning of what it means to be a human being. To be a full human being, I think, is to allow, is simply to let the obstacles out of the way that keep from the full functioning of our humanity, of our embodied experience of life, our emotional experience of life, our motivational experience of life, our interpersonal experience of life, our mental, intellectual experience of life. To let all these things function fully, rather than to narrow down different aspects of them and to avoid them. That freedom, the unconditioned, the non-dual, doesn't in any kind of way require us to turn away from anything. As you say in Mahayana Buddhism, form is emptiness is form. The unconditioned is the conditioned is the unconditioned. Distance, anything at a distance, means the curtains are closed. So please open your curtains and look around and notice who your neighbors are. And be kind to them. Aldous Huxley, at the end of his life, he wasn't a Buddhist, I don't think, but at the end of his life, after all his years of studying perennial philosophy and all the different spiritual traditions and exploring so much of it, I've read or was told that kind of near his deathbed, he said, you know, it's a little bit embarrassing for me to say this after all these years of study. Basically, it just comes down to be kinder to each other. So I apologize for talking over. I thought I had nothing to say today. And I thought that it would be good today to after these 12 talks, to give you a chance to ask your questions or raise your reservations around this developmental model. But maybe we should stop and is there something that interests you? You feel like there's a need to kind of give you a chance to respond to all these off talks, or should we just kind of in 2 weeks when I come back just kind of merrily go on to something new?
I just have a quick question.
Yes.
Okay. At the 12th step, when you talk about release of intoxicants, given that everything is impermanent, I suppose that these intoxicants can also come back in. So let's say I experience, you know, the release of hatred for a day, hour, and then it comes back. Is that right?
Well, this is interesting. So part of the release, the question is, since Buddhism puts tremendous focus on impermanence, on change, certainly when there's a release of the intoxicants, like anger, that release, absence of it, is almost also temporary. And so I can release my anger today or my hate today, and then tomorrow it will be back. You know, that's part of what impermanence means, right? So to back up a little bit, one of the fundamental principles of Buddhist psychology is that there is what's called the anusaya. Anusaya is usually translated into English as latent tendencies. Latent means we don't see them. So you could merely go along with your life for a long time and think that you've never, you have no tendency, you've uprooted all tendencies to be angry. And then suddenly someone cuts you off in traffic and you get angry. You realize, oh, that possibility, that potential for anger was still there. And the ultimate, in the depth of Buddhist practice, what we're trying to do is to uproot, is the actual traditional word, uproot that potential. So that potential, it gets removed once and for all. And so there's a permanent removal. And the permanent removal of something, the absence of something, doesn't contradict the experience, the teaching of impermanence. What's impermanent is all conditioned things that you can point to. The absence of something is not a thing. If you cut off your arm, you're not going to grow another arm. You know, that's it. It's gone, right? So if you cut off or eliminate or uproot the deep-seated potential, the unconscious, there's probably a good translation, good enough, subconscious, because it can be revealed. It doesn't stay in the unconscious or subconscious. If you uproot the subconscious potential or seeds for hate, then it never comes back. And one of the inspiring stories you hear from the Thai forest tradition is teachers who of monks who spent years practicing and felt that they were kind of pretty much convinced themselves that they were fully enlightened. And then they thought, well, maybe I'm not. Maybe I should test myself. And then somehow put themselves in situations where, after a long time, somehow a little bit of anger or a little bit of desire, sensual desire, was provoked for them. So, oh, I didn't finish the work yet. I thought I was done. And to me, that's very humbling and very, you know, that it's easy to fool oneself. And but the point is to really go into the ultimate point of Buddhist practice is to reach down there to the roots, the latent tendencies, and pluck them out. And then you won't have to hate anymore. Yes? They're connected. The 12 links of dependent origination, the way it was taught by the Buddha, was describes the precursors or the conditions for the arising of suffering. And that's a circle, because it kind of becomes a loop. The way we relate to suffering ultimately causes more suffering. If we have unhealthy ways of relating to suffering, it causes more suffering, and we kind of spin around and around and around. And so it's a wheel. And so that traditional 12 links that most people know about is describe suffering and what needs to be in place there for suffering. The transcendental or the liberative, maybe liberating 12 step chain or whatever is not a circle, because it doesn't come back on itself. Once you get liberated, it's like, you know, it's like a it doesn't create further suffering. It doesn't create more. Just, you know. Where the two 12-step programs overlap is they both have one of the links of suffering. And whereas in the traditional one, or the most well-known one, it's the first link is suffering is, you know, just goes around and around. In the liberative one, suffering becomes a springboard to step out of that endless cycle. Yes, Keith.
Unhappiness and depression.
Yeah, my understanding was that he changed, and that probably the relaxation allowed for something deeper to move through him. And what that deeper stuff is, the story doesn't say. But I've seen lots of people for whom they relaxed and finally willing to accept themselves as they are. And first, there's a tremendous amount of rage and grief or sadness that kind of, you know, bubbles up in powerful ways. And then there's a release of the holding of that as it kind of moves through us. And then there's increasing layers of relaxation, of love, of peace. And there's a whole process a person can be involved in. Once the resistance is let go of, or once the clinging is let go of, this all the stuff kind of like dominoes can happen.
Yeah, I guess that's just what I was asking. What it seems to be, that the relaxation, or what it means to be in peace, or the condition of the belt, and not clinging to the belt, so that it couldn't be because of the grasping.
I would word it a little bit differently. I think that the relaxation or the release is really a central element of Buddhist practice. Very, very important. But it's too limited to say that's the only thing we're supposed to do. Depending on any individual, different times of their life, different things are needed. And sometimes maybe we don't need any more letting go or release, or it's too difficult to do it. Or we can release to some things, but some things are just too difficult to release on our own. And so the developmental model means that there are also times that we should cultivate certain things. And there's actually also doing. A lot of people need to have some structure, in a sense, to hold release. Some people who get released prematurely will find their life is very confusing. They get very afraid. They have very confused relationships with other people because of that. So there's a time and a place for cultivation and actually doing. And it's okay to be involved in change. It's okay to be involved in trying to change oneself. But there's a place for not trying to change, just accept oneself, and there's a place for trying to change. And ultimately, from a certain perspective of liberation, they're the same thing. And we don't have to be at war with efforts to cultivate and change ourselves. We just have to understand clearly what the nature of that is. Does this make some sense? Is responding to you? Okay, thank you. Yeah.
I just wanted to thank you for doing this series. That was lovely in the beginning. Lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I hope it was enlightening for all of you. Who knows Alan Sinoki?